Water Environment Committee will come to order. Welcome, everyone. This is Tap Tap Day. If anybody doesn't know what that is, we're going to tap in a number of bills that we are unable to hear right now, but we're going to try to keep them alive. But we'll be tapping in and out. And we're going to begin that process as a subcommittee. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2148, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2148. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2166, close the public hearing on House Bill 2166. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2284, limit, excuse me, close the hearing on House Bill 2284. Don't read it. Open a hearing on House Bill 2370, close the hearing on House Bill 2370. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2543, closing the hearing on House Bill 2543. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2990, closing the public hearing on House Bill 2990. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3028, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3028.
Yeah, we actually already opened it.
One.
Okay, we can reopen it.
Okay, all right. I'm opening a hearing on House Bill 3115, closing the hearing on House Bill 3115. Opening the hearing on House Bill 3174, closing the hearing on House Bill 3174. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3198. And closing the hearing on House Bill 3198. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3204. Closing the hearing on House Bill 3204. Opening a hearing on House Bill 3392, which we will hear today if we have time. Closing the hearing on House Bill 3392. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3418. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3418. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3470. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3470. Opening the public hearing on House Bill 3482. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3482. Opening the public hearing on House Bill 3536. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3536. Opening the public hearing on House Bill 3585. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3585. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 3720, closing the hearing on House Bill 3720. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3773, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3773. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 3800, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3800. And finally, opening a public hearing on House Bill 3947, closing the public hearing on House Bill 3947. And committee, there was one bill we forgot, so we're going to be convening very briefly at
3 p.m. in hearing room 357.
3 p.m. hearing room 357, and we will be tapping in one bill and then adjourning. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2181 and have staff read the description.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2181 creates an invasive species council to promote reporting of undesirable non-native plants and animal invasion, to increase education about invasive species, and provide grants or loans for eradicating new introductions of undesirable non-native invasive species. It also abolishes the Interagency Integrated Pest Management Coordinating Committee, converting that to the Invasive Species Council. Thank you.
Hey, this is the Department of Agriculture's bill. Are you ready to present the bill?
Which bill is this? Which one? 2181.
Thank you. morning.
Good morning, Chair Close and members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and present this bill. Department of Agriculture brought this bill forward really address a problem that's associated with globalization, just increasing degree of global travel and commerce has subjected us more and more to the threat of invasive species. And I just realized, and I'm sure that I hadn't introduced myself, so for the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for Department of Ag, and with me is Dan Hilburn, the administrator of our plant division. The basic reason why we're bringing this bill forward at this time is to address what has become clear to us as a significant problem on the rise connected with invasive species. And to just give you a little background, Dan and I both came to the Department of Agriculture about the same time, 12 years ago. And at that time, there was kind of a test of the year. Basically one species that every year that became a problem that we had to deal with in kind of an urgent fashion, whether it was gypsy moth or grasshoppers or some kind of particular pest. It was usually about one instance a year. Today, it is more like one a month, and that is a direct result of the increased commerce and travel associated with the global economy. What this bill does is basically three things. It converts an obsolete program that we have into an invasive species council. It addresses the growing challenge of biological pollution that the natural resources of the state of Oregon face. And it positions us to utilize federal funds that would be expected to be dedicated to invasive species. So with that very broad overview, I think I'll ask Dan to rather briskly go through the bill and the amendments to the bill. And Madam Chair, we have not seen the amendments yet that we had provided you to address the issues that you brought up on the bill. So
I apologize. I should have got those two. We will have them copied and get them to you promptly.
All right.
They're on the way.
Very good. For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm administrator of the plant division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm going to walk you quickly through our testimony. Under background and justification, there in the first paragraph, you see a list of invasive species that are here in Oregon and causing us problems now. Things like yellow star thistle, Scotch broom, green crab, German yellow jacket, nutria, Himalayan blackberry, Dutch elm disease. Those are all examples of exotic organisms. They're non-native. They don't belong here in Oregon. They have become established and have spread, and they're now competing with our native plants and animals and causing lots of economic and environmental harm. And in the second paragraph, the point there is that we're still lucky. We don't have a lot of the really major nasty invasive species that are out there. Things like gypsy moth, Asian longhorn beetle, Chinese mitten crab, zebra mussels. There are many others that are knocking on the door that we don't have, and it would be very nice to keep them out as long as possible. The third paragraph deals with the IIPMCC, the Interagency Integrated Pest Management Coordinating Committee. This committee was set up about a decade ago to jumpstart state agencies for using IPM. And it's worked very well. It has done a good job, and IPM has become institutionalized in the state agencies that do pest management. So we're proud of the work that that committee has done, but it has really outlived its usefulness. On the back of the page, there's a short treatment of funding. The governor's budget did not include any additional money for the Invasive Species Council. So the only money involved here is $12,535 per biennium of general funds that currently supports the IIPMCC. Those would be converted to support just basic you know, the secretarial and mailing functions of the new Invasive Species Council. The membership that we're proposing would be four agencies would have permanent members on the council. These are the agencies which currently have responsibilities for invasive species in the state. The Department of Agriculture, we deal with plant pests and diseases, weeds and invertebrates. Fish and Wildlife, they deal with vertebrates and fish. Portland State University is the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs. They deal with aquatic nuisance species. And Oregon State University, the Sea Grant Program, is the center for expertise for marine organisms. Then the heads of those agencies would be able to appoint two additional members each at large from other agencies or other groups, interested industries, etc. The functions of the council have already been mentioned, and I won't belabor this, but there's a real need for reporting and coordinating of activities between agencies. We need to focus on the early part of when invasive species come in so that we can find them and get rid of them as quickly and as economically as possible. And finally, there in the conclusions, I just want to bring to your attention how important this is. A recent study, a 2000 study, indicated that noxious weeds are causing the state $83 million a year in annual losses. And that's just what we can document. There are many others. So we've got a problem here that continues to get worse, and we need to get better at addressing invasive species. So appreciate your considering this bill, and we hope you'll recommend that it move forward. Thank you. Oh, okay. There are some proposed amendments, and you should have a summary sheet there. First, we're proposing to add a definition of invasive species that would make it clear that we're not talking about humans or domestic livestock or biological control agents. There's, in my opinion, there's plenty of invasive species that we can agree on that are causing economic and environmental harm. That's where we ought to be targeting our efforts instead of debating whether or not humans or livestock are invasive. The second one, because the governor's budget didn't include any appropriation for additional monies, this would adjust that piece of it. The third bullet there, it would delete all references to the governor appointing members of the council. Originally, that was the idea that the governor would appoint and the Senate would confirm. That doesn't seem to make sense given that there's not going to be a budget for this committee, so we've modified that or suggested that a modification that would allow the agency heads then to support or appoint the at-large members of the council. The original bill, the council had rulemaking authority, and I think at this point that makes sense to take that out. And also the original bill did something that we didn't intend at all. It repealed a piece of the IPM statute that's really very important, and that piece directs state agencies to use integrated pest management techniques. That needs to be put back in because that is a good thing, and we would like to see that stay in the bill.
So it was removed from the dash ones?
No, it was removed from the original bill, and the dash ones, we would like that little piece put back in.
So we need a dash two, is that what you're saying?
I haven't seen the dash one, so hopefully okay. It's taken care of in the dash one.
We'll get it to you. Can you?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Beneficial biological control organisms. Is there some possibility that a specific beneficial biological control organism may in fact be found 10 years from now to be a threat to something?
So I can go ahead and answer.
Chair Close, Representative Jensen. That has happened. Historically, we have brought in organisms which we believed to, would be beneficial, and then over time, things have changed and they have turned out to have a negative side. And I think a perfect example is something like Scotch broom, which is blooming all over right now. That was brought in as an ornamental, and it was certainly considered beneficial for many decades. And it has some unfortunate characteristics, and now I think most people would consider it to be a very harmful plant.
Certainly has. Certainly has done a lot for the antihistamine business.
Oh, God, don't let him know.
Yeah, that lobby issue.
If I could follow a little bit with this, can there be some language protecting us on this in the, you know, in the dash or in the amendments, in event that we discover later? What happens, you know, if we discover later that it's not beneficial, that it's harmful? How do we address that to get it, you know? And I know we got it here, but let's not get any more of it, I guess, is the idea. Sort of thing. Yeah.
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, the idea for this committee is, I mean, the council, is really to concentrate on the front end when things are being introduced, or try to reduce the number of hitchhikers that are coming on cargo with trade and travel. That sort of issue that you're bringing up is very important, and I would think that the council would have a big part of that. Let me give you an example of the current system and how it works with something like Scotch broom, or just recently English ivy. That is a plant that has been considered beneficial and has been in the nursery trade for many years. And it has really been moving along the continuum from being considered beneficial to being more of a pest. And this past year, the state weed board debated that issue and listened to lots of testimony and decided to move it to the state noxious weed list. So there are mechanisms in place now for dealing with situations that, like the one that you bring up.
Okay. Thank you.
I see Portland State's on the list of members, and I don't know if there's anybody else here that's going to comment on that. I can wait, you know, for that. I was curious, you know, why them, and perhaps also why not like Port of Portland or someone like that.
Chair Close, Representative King, there is somebody from Portland State Center for Lakes and Reservoirs here, and you can ask them that question. The short answer is, in the state right now, the Centers for Expertise in Aquatic Nuisance Species is at Portland State University, Center for Lakes and Reservoirs.
If I could follow them. I'm seeing expertise on aquatics. And, you know, general appointments elsewhere, I'm not necessarily seeing, you know, expertise on the non-aquatics then. And it would be interesting to see what we're looking at in terms of, you know plant and non-aquatic animal species.
Chair Close, Representative King, the terrestrial weeds, insects, plant pests and diseases fall under the Department of Agriculture, and we are included also as a member of this council.
And could I ask you, too, on that, there would be nothing to preclude the Department of Agriculture from appointing Port of Portland, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah.
Can you tell me, in the amendment, I just want to make sure it's on page 2, line 16. What is the generally accepted definition of exotic?
Chair Close, exotic means non-native.
Okay.
There are many terms that get used. You can pick the one that means the most to you, but exotic means that it's not from around here. Not native.
Not from Hawaii or
those other exotic places.
Okay, Representative Jensen.
I'd like to follow on Representative King's line of questioning. And we certainly recognize the Department of Agriculture is here, you know, but we also would recognize the Department of Fish and Wildlife is here to deal with the aquatics, but we found it necessary to have other expertise, quote unquote, in that area, but not in the non. And I'm wondering if that is because it's the Department of Bill, or if there's more expertise than there is in the Fish and Wildlife, or.
Mr. Chair, I think we explicitly provided for Department of Fish and Wildlife to be on the Invasive Species Council. So we've recognized the expertise that that agency has and incorporated it into the concept.
I guess, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd still be, you know, even a little wondering why perhaps OSU would not be, Department of Agriculture at OSU might not be also part of the expertise that might be looked at here.
Madam Chair, Rep. Jensen, we included Oregon State University also in the list of membership.
The Sea Grant.
The Sea Grant College, right?
It's a little confusing because the amendment doesn't mention that, but the bill does, and it's not removed. The amendment doesn't remove that.
I see what your point is.
Okay.
No further than on that effect. Thank you. Great.
Representative Lee.
I can ask my question of Mr. Sitzma when he comes up. Thank you.
I just have one more question. You mentioned the State Weed Board. What is the difference between these two groups? What was the major difference?
Chair Closes, the State Weed Board is set up by statute to advise the department on weed-related issues for noxious weeds. They also maintain the official state list of noxious weeds, and it's made up of two county commissioners, two people from the agricultural industry, and then there's a couple of at-large members as well.
So they have, that's much, much more limited authority group, is that correct?
It's just noxious weeds.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to call Harry Witness if he has a meeting in half an hour.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify out of order. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Mm-hmm. I'll keep my comments very brief. We support this bill, particularly as it is proposed to be amended. I was part of the group that put together the Integrated Pest Management Bill back in 1991, of which part of the charge was to develop and initiate this, the Interagency Integrated Pest Management Coordinating Committee. As has been testified by the department, that coordinating council, I think, has served its purpose very well. IPM is now a very well integrated program process in all of state agencies, and I think the time has come to place some additional emphasis on invasive species and getting that very serious problem under control in the state. I want to specifically say we support the changes to the definition. There was a concern about the potential elimination of beneficial, non-harmful exotic species, particularly in areas where you might have fires and have to go in and reseed with material that would not have been considered native grasses, but which do not pose a threat to the environment. That's really about all I have. We would like to lend our support to this and think it's a worthwhile bill. Unfortunately, we can't give them any more money than $12,000, which I think is incredible for any state agency-run program. But with that, I'll close.
you very much.
Next, we have Dr. Denny Lasek.
Morning, Madam Chair. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the American Fisheries Society. I have with me Dr. Denny Lassie from the Fisheries Society. He's president of our association. I think most of you are familiar. I just briefly want to state that the American Fisheries Society is not an advocacy organization. We are a scientific society. We represent a large percentage of the fish scientists in the state of Oregon. It's actually a national organization. I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon chapter. Our job as a scientific society is to keep our members abreast of the new information on aquatic science, and we have a lot of meetings and seminars to present papers to each other and to give each other a chance to extend our research information. We do also have a role in our charter of educating the public on scientific information, and in the legislature is my role to bring scientists here when there are issues that involve science, so that when you're making your policy decisions, you can take the science into account on those policy decisions.
Thank you. I understand there's a lot of business to cover today, and there are other witnesses who will cover some of the material that I had in my written testimony, so I'll just excerpt parts of it for you.
Please give your name again.
Yeah, I was going to say, as Stephen noted, my name is Denny Lassie. I am the current president of the Oregon chapter of the American Fisheries Society, and I'm here representing the chapter in my testimony. This is one area, often society leads science, and this is one area where science seems to actually have a clue and is having a difficult time getting the broader public to understand, but I'm very impressed in the state of Oregon that this legislative body seems to have a pretty solid understanding of invasive species issues and the concerns around them. And really, that's the bottom line of my testimony today, is to applaud the positive steps of the legislature and to endorse the concepts that are captured in this bill. I'm going to highlight only one particular species because others are going to talk about them, and that one particular species is a bit infamous. It's the zebra mussel. Zebra mussel was introduced to the Great Lakes by way of ballast water and then spread throughout the Great Lakes Basin and throughout the Mississippi River Basin by boats and barges. And an upcoming event that should be very worrisome to the Northwest and very joyful to the Northwest at the same time is the upcoming bicentennial celebration of the Lewis and Clark expedition. As you're well aware, that was a waterborne expedition. There's going to be hordes of boats and boaters reenacting that expedition. As you know, the Lewis and Clark Trail passed through the Midwest, which is now heavily infested with zebra mussels. It ended here in Oregon, right in the heart of highly mechanized water distribution systems and fish passage screens and such. And if zebra mussels make their way out here, we're not only talking about tremendously complicating the job of salmon restoration, but extremely expensive undoing of the damages that zebra mussels are likely to do to irrigation systems and other water distribution mechanisms in the West. So the recognition of invasive species as an issue is extremely important, and so the chapter endorses that awareness. We endorse the tasks that are put forth in Section 7 of this bill for the Invasive Species Council to work on. We believe that if nothing else has come out of the science of invasive species, it has been that prevention and rapid response are both extremely important, and the bill very positively supports both of those actions in terms of its direction to the Invasive Species Council under Section 7. I have not seen the full set of amendments, and so the testimony that I'm providing here is based on the bill. However, I would be very happy to volunteer the chapter's efforts to work with the committee and with any others who are drafting amendments or considering other amendments to the bill. Thank you.
Can you tell us how do you eradicate the zebra mussel?
Unfortunately, I don't think you can eradicate it with current technology. That's why prevention is extremely important. You can, even if you can't eradicate it from an entire drainage, like something the size of the Mississippi River drainage, what you can do through education, monitoring, and coordinated efforts is slow its spread, and even slowing its spread or preventing it from getting to a few places within there can save a tremendous amount of money in damages.
But once it's there, what do you do?
You deal with it. You have to find ways to deal with it. In the Midwest, that means building redundant systems so that you can close one down while you clean it out and keep it functioning. That's been particularly important, obviously, in things like municipal water supplies and power plant cooling towers and that sort of thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mark Sisma, Portland State University.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Sitsema. I'm an associate professor of environmental sciences and resources and director of Center for Lakes and Reservoirs at Portland State University. I urge the adoption of House Bill 2181. The bill will really formalize a critical need in Oregon, and that's a more coordinated and collaborative approach to management of invasive species. This sort of collaborative approach that's really set up in this bill is really necessary because the management of these creatures, animals and plants, is really spread among several different agencies. Department of Ag, of course, is responsible for noxious weed management. ODF&W is responsible for invasive animal management. Many agencies have roles. Marine Board really deals with boaters, and boats are a primary method of dispersal of some of these species. So we have a lot of different agencies that have roles to play in this, and so I think the Invasive Species Council will bring them all together and put together a coordinated program that will be more efficient in the state. Passing out some mitten crabs. This is a creature that's in California that we don't have yet. Again, another instance of where prevention is what we need to be doing. There's no management. There's just sort of palliative treatment is all we can do for these things. We build redundant systems so we can clean them out. And I'll also pass around a small little jar of zebra mussels that Dr. Lassie mentioned a minute ago. And they look rather innocuous in a little jar like that, but if you could imagine hundreds of thousands of them clogging fish screens and fish ladders, they could create a huge problem in Oregon. I want to mention the fact that we have put together the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs has put together an aquatic nuisance species management plan. The Invasive Species Council is critical to implementing that plan, and it will allow us to really coordinate our functions better. The plan is currently in draft form, and if any members of the committee would like to see it, I'd be happy to provide a copy. We're looking for comments. At this point, we don't have any money to implement the plan, but we will, with the plan is approved by the federal ANS task force, we will be able to apply for some federal grant money to help implement the plan. And to address Representative King's comment, Portland State recently, just this past week, the Senate passed House Bill 2198, which establishes the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs at Portland State University and charges us with mitigation and management of aquatic nuisance species in Oregon. So that's what we do, and that's why we're on there. So with that, I urge the support of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Jensen.
I guess a question and a concern. As you've indicated, the mitten crab is already in the Bay Area. And it's my understanding it's a rather prolific species. How come it hasn't gotten here by now?
Well, one of them has. Well, we found one in the Columbia River, and it probably came on a ship.
Yeah.
The one we found in the Columbia was not a Chinese mitten crab, it was a Japanese mitten crab. So it probably came from across the ocean on a ship. And there is a bill to to address sort of shipping-related issues. Senate Bill 895, I believe it is. And that sets up sort of a ballast water exchange program. So that's an important part. That's identified in our management plan as a really an important element. So they are here. They just haven't been, they haven't arrived in the numbers that can establish a really dense population. We have a monitoring program right now in the Columbia River. My graduate student that runs the program is sitting in the audience. So we're trying to identify how big the population is.
That's a real challenge for us.
Yes.
Can I ask you on the mitten crab how you deal with it once you get infested?
With a lot of these animal species, there really isn't any control of the populations, very effective control. You have to sort of, as Dr. Lassie mentioned, sort of engineer solutions. So you build, in California, they built expensive traveling screens that sort of carry them away from the fish screens, and they get deposited into a holding facility, and then they take them, they truck them out and bury them is what they do, truckloads of these things. So it's more engineering fixes. There's no real control of them. It's just sort of mitigating their impacts.
So there's no chemical control?
Well, there are certainly chemicals that can kill mitten crabs and zebra mussels, but there's been some recent court decisions that really prohibit use of pesticides in water. Too bad Representative Lee isn't here. She could inform you about that much more than I could. So the chemical control, although it's practical and could be done, are really some real constraints on using those kind of chemicals, particularly where endangered species are a problem.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Paul Heimowitz, Oregon Sea Grant.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Paul Heimowitz, and I'm a member of the Extension faculty with Oregon Sea Grant Program based at Oregon State University. And I'm pleased to echo support for House Bill 2181 on behalf of Oregon Sea Grant and Oregon State University. Oregon Sea Grant delivers research and education programs regarding wise use of coastal and aquatic resources. And the ecological and economic impacts of aquatic invasive species are certainly important aspects of our focus. And handouts that are going around just describe a little bit of some of those activities. In fact, back in the 1980s, Oregon Sea Grant supported research in Coos Bay by marine biologist Jim Carlton regarding the role of ships' ballast water in transporting non-native organisms around the world. And it was Carlton's pioneering research that helped lead to the current regulatory focus and attention on preventing ballast water introductions, including Senate Bill 895 that Dr. Sitzma mentioned here in Oregon. A year ago, Oregon Sea Grant organized a one-day conference in Corvallis on biological invasions. We had a tremendous turnout, which was an encouraging sign that this issue is gaining attention in Oregon, similar to the growing interest on a national and international scale. Particularly with aquatic habitats, invasive species are often out of sight, out of mind. The recent arrival of the European green crab, now present in most of Oregon's estuaries, is a good reminder of the continuing susceptibility of our state's waters and habitats in general to biological invasions and the need for coordinated prevention, detection, and control strategies. The principles behind managing invasions in aquatic environments translate to pastures, to forests, to any terrestrial habitats and environments. And so it's important for organizations in Oregon to address this issue holistically. As you heard earlier, we're relatively lucky in Oregon. We don't have zebra mussels clogging our power plant pipes. We don't have mitten crab crawling up our fish ladders. We don't have the Asian clam Potama corbula, which is blanketing the bottom of our of bays in San Francisco. We are lucky that we don't have that here at this point. But again, we know the risks are there, and the prevention aspect of this council and its other coordination activities will help us stave off the problem. The Invasive Species Council established by this bill is an important step towards developing a comprehensive program in the state, and I encourage your action to support it. Thank you.
Question. I guess I've got one for you. We recently had a decision down in Klamath County about the use of water for irrigation and the conflicts with salmon. And so I'm looking at your description of the MIST program, What are the chances that, I want to be sure that the science that comes out of groups like that is based on a scientific method, not on a political agenda? How do you assure that?
I think that's an important question, particularly with Oregon Sea Grant and the research that we fund, a very strong peer review process where we ensure that we have other scientists looking at the methods used. We have funded a number of research projects related to salmon. We funded a number of research projects related to invasive species. One interesting relationship that we haven't really looked at in the state that this council could certainly support and support the science behind it would be the links between invasive species and salmon, which are certainly a potential problem and would be relevant to the energy that we're putting towards salmon restoration in the state.
Are you going to consider human beings? I guess it's my question.
Well, similar to the amendments which I just saw this morning, the focus with Oregon Sea Grant and certainly the focus of the bill that we support are on the plant and animal species that we know are causing problems either elsewhere, like the mitten crab, or here in our state, like a number of the freshwater weeds that we have, the European green crab that I mentioned earlier. So, our focus is certainly on plants and animal species and those that we can't see. The focus on ballast water recently has taken a turn towards microorganisms, pathogens and bacteria that are being transported around the world, and that's an important aspect that needs to be dealt with in Oregon as well.
Thank you. Next we have Larry Cooper, is it? Oregon Fish and Wildlife?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Cooper, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And knowing that you have a full schedule here today and there's a lot of experts that came before me that had a lot of good comments, I'll keep mine very brief. The invasive species issue has been outlined very well. It is definitely harmful to crops, private property, the economy, as well as fish and wildlife. The establishment of this invasive species council outlined in this bill would provide an important comprehensive step towards controlling or attempting to control these non-native invasive species. I have seen the Dash 1 amendments and believe that they only strengthen the bill. The Department of Fish and Wildlife supports House Bill 2181, and thank you for your allowing me to offer those comments today, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for the department? None, thank you.
I did have a question.
Representative King?
As I'm reading the bill, I'm not seeing that this council has the ability to define that something is a pest. Is that something that we really look to this council to do, or are they doing other functions, educate and have an internet site? But does this body have the ability to determine what is a pest? Are we replacing some other council's ability to do that, or do we leave it to another council and this court just coordinates?
Madam Chair, Representative King, I see this particular piece of legislation of being very supportive and very very integrated with other programs similar to the one that we have in the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is the establishment of a task group that looks at defining non-native species in regard to their potential harmful effects to native wildlife and to develop some rules based on those findings. I see this group as being very very supportive and very integrated into that system and providing input to the public as to what is invasive and what isn't and how those can tie together.
Follow up.
And if you're not the right person, let me know and we'll try and get the right answer. But where would we go if we're going to try and discern whether a species is beneficial or invasive? It looks like this council doesn't do that. Who would do that if we ever needed to know that?
Madam Chair, Representative King, my belief is that different agencies have different responsibilities. So we had looked at those agencies that have the responsibilities for those different organisms. For example, Department of Fish and Wildlife would look at fish and wildlife. Department of Agriculture would look at plants. And so those, inside those agencies would where, is where those discussions would occur and development of rules would happen. I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I'm getting to your answer.
That's fine. Maybe we'll have an answer somewhere along the line, yeah.
I apologize.
Further questions? Representative Cruz.
I'm kind of following on Representative King. For example, the Tule chub that's in Diamond Lake and several other lakes, which is clearly an invasive species, do you see this as being a vehicle for helping get resolution on things like that, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, I believe that this mechanism helps educate people as to what those problems are. The Department of Fish and Wildlife currently would be looking at any invasive species that would be potentially harmful, no matter what that might be.
Okay, I guess, I mean, the department knows certainly about to each other, and the department knows the best way to deal with it, which we are, of course, restricted from doing because of interaction with some federal agencies at this point in time. I guess I'm just wondering if this helps us raise the level for an advocacy for solutions here.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, yes, I think this definitely is a vehicle to raise awareness for various issues relative to invasiveness and invasive species in particular.
Just one more follow-up. I noticed you in your testimony you mentioned nutria. If you need some to study, come down to my farm and
thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cruz. Thank you very much. Pete Tech, on the road.
He just stepped down.
Representative Cruz, can you, Ms. Johnson, would you ask, would you see if Pete Tess is...
I was looking.
Oh, I'll see.
I'll see if I can find
him. It's hard to...
No, stand at ease.
You can give that time off for that bar money.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He flew out.
I can't give it to him enough today. That's right now. So we've done all the tasks, huh?
Was there a reason to miss that one? You didn't catch.
Well, I know they had a board meeting somewhere, so perhaps we had to go. There's no one else to testify, I believe, on this bill. So we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2181. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2181.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2181.
Okay, the Representative Johnson moves the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 2181. Is there discussion? Does everybody understand the Dash 1 amendment and what it does? They all do. Okay, is there any objection to the Dash 1? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I move House Bill 2181 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. House Bill 2181 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen has moved House Bill 2181 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I always welcome the opportunity to create more government.
Actually, this eliminates
Hey, don't step on my joke.
Okay, well, government where government is due, I guess.
Who knows?
Okay, further discussion, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
That's Friday, we got a little time, though.
I agree.
Is excused to the dentist.
Aye.
Is excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Full time. Motion carries. Representative Monica Anderson, would you carry this bill?
Probably I'm the person who is least knowledgeable about this subject.
Would you rather not?
I would be glad to if she wouldn't like to. It's something I've worked on in the past, so I know a little about it.
Is that acceptable?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Lee will carry this bill.
It would have been a going.
Thank you very much. It would have been. Congratulations to the Department of Agriculture.
Our condolences.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3654. And the staff will read the description.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 3654 authorizes a lot of record dwelling on lot parcels lawfully created before October 5th, 1973, within farm or forest land.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hayden, is he in the room?
He's
here he comes.
Yeah.
Representative, would you like to present this bill? Are you ready to testify? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is, for the record, my name is Cedric Lee Hayden, State Representative from District 43, a rural district. In real life, I am a Christmas tree farmer, a working Christmas tree farmer, a timber and stockman with beef, horses, timber, and Christmas trees. I have 6 children and 9 grandchildren. I am also a dentist. I'm here today to support House Bill 3654, which is sponsored by several senators and representatives whose names you will note at the top of the bill. House Bill 3654 would authorize a lot of record dwelling on a lot or parcel lawfully created before a certain date. House Bill 3654 is presented in the spirit of Senate Bill 100. It is a modest proposal to enhance the quality of life in Oregon. It is a new beginning, a clean slate for you to draw upon, a fresh start. The reason we need a new beginning is that bills and administrative rule and legislation pile one on top of the other, just as budgets do, just as we have for many years hoped for zero-based budgeting in our agencies. It's sometimes good just to start fresh with new verbiage for our laws. In this particular case, let me just skim through some of the verbiage that has accumulated over the years with regards to lots of record. Comprehensive plan and land use regulations, high-value farmland, habitat of big game, extraordinary circumstances, not protected, 21 acres or less, tract is bordered on at least 67% of its perimeter, tract is bordered on at least 25% of its perimeter. 2 of the 4 dwellings may lie within the urban growth boundary, irrigated and classified, not irrigated and classified, specified perennials, aerial photography, soils, Cornelius variant, Helvetia, Hillsborough, conjunction with a dairy operation, subclassification, specifically Astoria, Hembry, soil class, soil rating, soil designation may be changed. Soundly and scientifically based, intact exterior walls and roof structure, indoor plumbing, interior wiring, heating system, replacement, removed, demolished, periodic review, hardship, caretaker residence, contested case hearing, Office of Energy, Environmental Quality, Consumer Business Affairs, Fire Marshal, Division of State Lands, Public Utility Commission, Water Resources Commission, Land Conservation and Development, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Willamette Valley. The dwelling is a lotter parcel, that is generally unsuitable land for the production of farm crops, not stocked to the requirements under ORS 527.610, composed of at least 95% soils, not capable of producing 50 cubic feet per acre. Additional taxes imposed upon the change in use have been paid, small-scale farmland, secondary land, marginal land provisions, and so on. Madam Chair, I submit that I am not an expert in land use law. I do employ a land use expert, a planner, a lot. And he tells me with some heat that the laws that we have heaped upon him are about this high. He actually shows them to me. I go to his office and he says, Cedric, I want you to know what you people are doing to us. I'm here somewhat in his defense today also. This bill pretty simply eliminates a lot of that verbiage and allows you a fresh start, and it also changes may to shall in many cases. It is, in fact, a companion of Senate Bill 100. House Bill 3654 is a companion of Measure 7 because this type of thinking and compensation for regulatory takings were to be included in Senate Bill 100. They are not, and we have to reinvent the wheel. Now, I have 6 kids and 9 grandkids. I want them to live in Oregon. They don't particularly want to live in a high-rise tenement complex by a light rail line where they get an 80% property tax deduction for being crowded into such a place. They want to live in the country. They think the quality of life is enhanced by living in the country. One of my sons has been going through the process. It is 5 years and counting now for him to get his permit and get a house built. The house is 90% completed. He will make it, but it has taken him 5 years and more thousands of dollars than you can believe to do that. People who follow me will present various amendments for your attention. We do want to be sensitive to the needs of all interested parties. There are a number of possibilities that you may be interested in. There is in ORS 215.284, Section 6, Sub 2, Part B, page 6 of this bill that says a dwelling is situated upon a lot or parcel or portion of a lot or parcel that is generally unsuitable land for the production of farm crops and livestock or merchantable tree species, considering the terrain, the adverse soil or land conditions, drainage and flooding, vegetation, location, and size of the tract. I would submit that there are many, many areas outside the urban growth boundaries where family residence for our kids, ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, can be conducted without harming other uses. In fact, enhancing the use of the area. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I commend House Bill 3654 to your consideration, and I thank you for your time.
Questions for, excuse me, Representative Hayden. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, we have in front of us -1 through 4 amendments. Can you speak to those on any or all that you're in favor of?
I have glanced at the amendments, Representative Cruz. I note that some of them would change the effective date of House Bill 3654. I have no problem with that. Whatever date this committee feels would be most appropriate is fine with me. I notice that one of the amendments is a referral to the people of the state of Oregon, and if that would be suitable for the committee, that would be perfectly acceptable with me. I didn't mention one concept that you might pursue, which is transferable property development. I believe that's the term of art, transferable property rights development, where if a legal lot of record is in a particularly sensitive that person might be given permission to build a home in a less sensitive area, which would be, I presume, designated by the state and probably under one of those areas as found in ORS 215.284 that we discussed on page 6.
The -2 changes the date, the beginning date from October 5th, 1972 1973 to January 1st, 1985. Wouldn't why we would do that?
I think you'll have to ask. I think that there will be people who will testify as to why that would be preferable. I don't really understand. It seemed to me, in a simplistic sort of sense, that if we made the date the same date as Senate Bill 100, that we would have addressed the problem. But in this business, sometimes we create problems by trying to solve problems.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, can you just tell us who the authors of the four amendments are?
I authorized the four amendments. They were drafted by Legislative Council at the request of Mr. Levy, I believe.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Birch, Department of Forestry.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Birch from the Department of Forestry. House Bill 3654 would authorize a lot of record dwellings on large portions of the industrial forest land base and on other parcels that are now deep in the forest that are very close to those industry lands. I tried to get an estimate of how much land we're talking about, and I really don't have hard numbers for you. I asked the former head of OFIC what his feelings were on it, and his sense was that we're talking about more than half of the forest land base when we're talking about a lot of record on this bill.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Are you referring to the 1973 date of the original bill, or are you referring to any of the amendments?
Chair and Representative King, none of the amendments changed that 1973 date. All of them would have that 1973 date in them.
That's not my understanding of the amendments.
The dash 2 changes that date.
If the dash 3 amendments, if you look at the dash 3 amendments, the dash 3 amendments give you an either or choice on forest land. They give you the current lot of record possibilities, or they give you any parcel that was purchased prior to 1973.
If I could follow.
Follow up.
My understanding of dash 1, 2, and 4 amendments are that it does change the dates. And, for example, on the dash 1s, it changes, it deletes October 5th, 1973, and inserts the date 2001 Act. But I think that you're saying that you're working off the 1973 date, and that would be half of the parcels.
Chair Anderson, Representative King, that's correct. As I read the dash 3 amendments, they would have a dwelling possibility. A dwelling under this section may be allowed if the lot or parcel was lawfully created and was acquired by the present owner before October 5, 1973.
Representative Jensen.
Madam Chair, am I correct that you're assuming that if we move this bill that we will adopt the dash 3 amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, either in the current bill without the dash 3 amendments or with the dash 3 amendments, you still have that 1973 effective date or date where any parcel purchased before that can get a lot of record dwelling. I believe that is the intent of the author on this particular bill and is consistent throughout the amendment. When the 1993 legislature looked at the fairness issue, they were trying to balance two separate questions. The first was, when did landowners purchase forest lands where they could reasonably expect to practice forestry free from residential conflicts? And the flip side of that coin, when did landowners purchase a parcel where they could, with reasonable investment-backed expectations, that they could build a dwelling? In a bipartisan compromise, the 93 legislature came up with three tests that they wanted to use to try that on forest lands. If they had a smaller, less productive tract, if it was close to a state or county highway where they could expect to get government services, or they purchased it before 1985, which was the date when all of the land use plans were finished. Then the legislature at that time said, someone who really does have this legitimate investment-backed expectation, that they purchased the parcel where they could build a dwelling. The flip side of the coin was that other parcels, larger, more productive parcels that were out deeper in the forest lands, were purchased for their forest values, for their commercial forest values, and not for a residential value. And that's how the 93 legislature, if you will, like Solomon, cut the baby in half and gave us the rules that we've got on forest land now. Broadcast burning, spraying herbicides with helicopters, yarding, hauling timber, those are very high industrial activities that conflict with residential uses. And we believe the current lot of record provisions do a better job of separating those commercial and those residential uses in forest zones. And we would prefer to keep the current lot of record provisions rather than going with in just a 1973 date. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, the next on the list is Carrie Kirshner, 1000 Friends of Oregon.
Not very good wheels we have here. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Kirshner. I'm the staff attorney specializing in farm and forest land for 1000 Friends of Oregon. 1000 Friends of Oregon strongly opposes House Bill 3654. I'm going to speak sort of somewhat collectively about all the amendments together because I think under any pattern or under any offered amendment or the original bill, House Bill 3654 will authorize a dwelling on every single lot or parcel within an exclusive farm or forest zone that was acquired under the original bill between or before October 5, 1973, under the Dash 1 amendments, before whenever this law would go into effect, under the Dash 2s, a 1985 date, which only makes my statistics sort of more significant, under the Dash 3 amendments, as was explained, either before 73 under certain conditions or and keeping the existing lot of record provisions, and Dash 4 would simply be a referral measure. I have these maps of Yamhill County before you. The first map, if I may get up, this first map is illustrates residential development in Yamhill County and rural zones as of 1975. If we look at this map, it illustrates the rural residential land patterns as of 1993. And I think the dots actually all out here in the green zone, as well as the sort of yellowish thing, represent dwellings probably too far away to tell, but the houses that are more diamond-shaped were built before 1975. Those that are dotted represent houses built between the period of 1975 and 1983. This map here shows a hypothetical development pattern based on ownership records that we were able to acquire in 1996 of houses in farm and forest zones for Yamhill County if each water parcel that is lawfully created had a house on it. Significant development. And I bring this to your attention not to say that all of these, each one of these different amendments would do that. Certainly, these Ash 1 amendments that change the date to present, this is what you would see in Yamhill County, which I think represents a devastating loss of both our farm and forest lands for this region. Yamhill County was ranked number 5 for Oregon's agricultural commodities in the year 2000, so it's not an insignificant loss in terms of both to our economy and our resource land base. To put it in perspective, in 1997, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture Census, Yamhill County produced $162,837,000 of gross farm sales. Having some structural issues. I think that something that's important when we consider this too is that historically in Oregon, there were a large number of what we call the sagebrush subdivisions, or the orchard platting that occurred in Yamhill and Polk County, or different areas of eastern Oregon, where large parcels of land were subdivided and platted out into parcels, you know, 5 to 10 acres in size is not uncommon. What this bill would do is that if I owned 100 acres, which had typically been in farm production, and that 100 acres was divided up into 10 acre parcels, I would be able to receive authorization not for one dwelling on my land, but for 10 dwellings on my land. That's why you see the results that I've sort of depicted here in this map. I have not been able to get exact statistics, but in some of the analysis that we did this past fall, the number of at least 50% of the ownership being the same as in 1973, as was suggested on the forest side by Kevin Birch, I think is at least a plausible number to begin working with. And I have cause to think in some of the even more rural areas, there may have been less turnover of the parcels. I won't belabor the issues with respect to House Bill 3661 that was discussed by Kevin Birch. That was a significant balance of sort of reasonable expectations, perhaps, of development, as well as a recognition to maintain our farm and forest zones for resource use, consistent with the state's agricultural lands policy. In short, House Bill 3654 would destabilize Oregon's agricultural and timber economies by removing countless parcels of productive farm and forest land from the state's commercial land base, and discouraging farm investment and forest management by introducing conflicts from increased residential development. I want to bring to light one other issue that I think is significant with respect to House Bill 3664. House Bill 3664 removes the county's authority under 215.705, subsection 5, to adopt criteria that restricts the development of such dwellings in rural zones where they exceed the facilities and service capabilities of an area. So House Bill 3664, in effect, can strain and probably will strain the budgets of local governments that are already struggling to provide basic services such as road maintenance, fire control and suppression, and solutions to a host of other problems that are associated with unplanned rural growth. I think that's a significant issue that this committee needs to look at when they analyze what is another impact of allowing rural development in areas that are currently unplanned. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, as I said at the outset, strongly opposes this bill because we do not believe it does anything to protect our farm and forest land as required by state statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have, and thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. We don't see any more citizens. Ron Eber of the department.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The department as well has significant concerns regarding House Bill 3654. This bill both expands and repeals a number of provisions with regard to dwellings in farm and forest zones. It's our assessment that this would allow a lot more development in those areas. I think significantly the bill removes provisions with regard that were carefully crafted in the early 90s to balance and ensure that development on existing lots and parcels on high-value farmland or in forest areas would not conflict with those existing farm and forest operations. This bill and all the amendments would remove those provisions that try to balance the protection of the higher quality resource lands with development on those. It also would make these provisions mandatory, and particularly would make them applicable in Lane and Washington counties. Those are the two counties that use the marginal lands provisions. Both at the time the marginal lands provisions went in and in 1993, those counties were given a choice. They could keep the ability to designate marginal lands, or they could choose the lot of record provision. And at this point, those counties have chosen to retain the marginal lands provisions. This would give them yet another set of provisions to allow development on top of the marginal lands provisions. So with that, I heard the objections. We would be gravely concerned with this provision going forward. I think it would be valuable for the committee to get from counties some of the plat maps that were referred to by Thousand Friends. I have seen some of those. I think we have some in the office. There are countless old subdivisions that were platted back in the early 1900s that are in Polk and Yamhill counties. And in the Lane County, what are called the fruit orchard tracts, and a lot of subdivisions, the old sagebrush subdivisions in eastern Oregon. In many cases, those parcels are under 5 acres because the early subdivision laws, you were exempt from the subdivision law if the lot or parcel was less than 5 acres. So there are huge areas with many platted lots. Less than 5 acres, some in single ownership, some in common family ownership, and there would be, this bill would open all of those up for a development and a dwelling right. So with that, if there's any questions, Madam Chair.
Can you just briefly tell us about these marginal lands counties, what their marginal land statutes say?
Yeah, Madam Chair. In 1983, the legislature passed a marginal lands law that allowed those counties to identify certain lands that were deemed marginal, of low productivity, either on the basis that the land quality was low or it had achieved a certain level of development and parcelization that allowed it to be designated marginal land. So, there is an area in Washington County, I don't know the exact acreages, I could get those for you, that has been designated marginal lands, and Lane County as well adopted those provisions. In return, they were allowed to use what were deemed at that time some more restrictive exclusive farm use zone provisions that are still in the books in 215, 213. In 1993, when the 3661 was passed, the ability for any new counties to adopt the marginal lands provisions was removed, and they were given instead the lot of record provisions and these other dwelling opportunities. The marginal lands counties were given a choice. They could either opt into the lot of record law, or they could retain the marginal lands provisions. And to date,
so you're saying Washington and Lane do not have the lot of record, is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. They do not use those provisions at this time.
Thank you. Question?
Thank you very much.
Harlan Levy is next. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. When I saw that this bill was coming up, I went and sought out the sponsor to it. We support the bill, the philosophy behind the bill, but we had some issues with the way the bill was written. Primarily, the problem with the bill as drafted is that a whole class of people that are currently eligible for a dwelling would no longer be eligible for a dwelling. Those people that obtained ownership of their of their parcel between October 5th, 1973, and January 1st, 1985, would have lost the ability to site a dwelling on their land, assuming that they would have met the current lot of record requirements. So when I sought out Representative Hayden, I mentioned that to him, and he said, well, why don't we make some amendments? So the purpose of the four amendments that you have before you today is to provide you with a menu, so to speak, of different options, should you wish to amend this bill and move it forward. And we support any one of the four amendments. They do various things. I'd be happy to go through them with you one by one. And I apologize for the tardiness. I just received them this morning myself. I was downstairs photocopying feverishly, make enough copies for this committee. Okay, the dash one amendments would simply remove any date requirement so that anybody that had a lawfully created parcel as of the effective date of this act would be eligible to receive a dwelling. The dash two amendments would replace the October 5th, 1973 date, which is significant because that is the date that Senate Bill 100 became effective, removing that and placing January 1st, 1985, which is the current date for the lot of record provisions. That date is also significant because all counties' comprehensive plans had been acknowledged by that date. The dash three amendments, which I have been informed are not entirely accurate, but the purpose behind the dash three amendments was to keep the current lot of record provisions for those individuals that acquired ownership of their parcel prior to 1985, but at the same time open it up for those that have owned it since Senate Bill 100 became effective. So in effect, you wouldn't be writing out those that class that I mentioned to you earlier. They would still be eligible as they are under current law, and in addition to that, if they had owned it prior to October 73, then they would be able to cite it without having to jump through all the hoops of the lot of record provision. However, this amendment does change the definition of owner, so we would have to fix that. That was an unintentional byproduct of the drafting. Finally,
Is that in on line five, the designee? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, the current law provides that an owner can be several different categories of people. And, you know, I was discussing this with Mr. Eber earlier, and to his credit, he pointed that out to me. I didn't really have a chance to go over it, but I see what he's saying. We would need to go back and make sure that definition of owner does not change, because current law provides that different people, such as those that receive it via will or intestacy, can qualify as the owner, even if they, you know, inherited it after that 1985 date. Finally, the dash four amendments are identical to the dash one amendments, except for the fact that they would be going to a vote of the people via the referral process. Basically, in a nutshell, this bill is about fairness. It's about letting people build a house on their own land, which, you know, in most states in this country is allowed, is the American dream. In this state, for whatever reason, we have, you know, piled regulation upon regulation over the years. And I wanted to point out to this committee that the current land use system is a far cry from what had been intended in 1973 with the passage of Senate Bill 100. It's just moved further and further into the extreme. And this bill, in our opinion, would bring it back to where it should be. With that, I will close my public testimony and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next, we have Don Schellenberg from the Farm Bureau.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau actually supports the current lot of record provisions. Reading our policy book, I'm not going to read it to you, but our policy book opposes changing the date from 1985, so any of the amendments that would change dates, we would be opposed to. Regarding high value, a lot of record on high value has been a discussion, and that's not really the focus of the discussion here today necessarily, but it's involved, because if you did do the bill as drafted, it would allow a lot of record dwellings on all high value farmland as well. What our policy calls for regarding high value farmland is a study to see what the impacts of that would be. What our main concern in agriculture is our agricultural infrastructure. There are many, many non-farm uses that are allowed in the EFU zone. Each of those has an effect on the agricultural infrastructure. Each one that in some way takes land out of production, takes very productive land and maybe turns it into less productive or higher, lower value crops, low intensive crops. Each of those things has an impact on the suppliers that we deal with, on the processors that we depend on, and so we're very concerned when those kinds of things happen, and those can happen very easily with lot of record. That's why we feel before we support a lot of record on high-value farmland, we need to have a study to see what the impacts are going to be on the agricultural community. So we would oppose, I think it was the -4 amendments that would send this to a vote of the people, because that would not provide opportunity for any kind of study. So I guess I'll close with that, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Okay, I guess I have one, Don. You mentioned the policy book that opposes the date change. I'd just like you to explain to me why people back to the 73 date of Senate Bill 100, why, in your opinion, shouldn't they be entitled to the lot of record?
My understanding of the issue is that on other than high-value farmland, which we allow now, lot of record, that up through 1985, everyone should have known if they bought a parcel after 1985, they should have known what their rights to build were, and so they don't have a complaint technically. Anybody prior to 1985, we believe, should be allowed to have a water record dwelling. Now, the one caveat to that would be what they called, I think, the orchard developments, where somebody years ago went out and put in a plat of a subdivision. Certainly, they ought to be allowed one dwelling on those water records, but not 10. That would cause a significant change in farming in that community.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll go to Jim Welsh.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Family Farm Association, and we certainly support this bill and the amendments. We believe that it has been our heritage ever since the movement from the East Coast to the West Coast has begun and continued, that rural growth is what it's all about. And we certainly plead the fairness issue. We think that most of the people that would be developing would be a single residence in an area that they would be farming and doing forestry. And I think it's just over-exaggerated when they start fearing a lot of development in those areas. That's not what we want. We are hoping that most of these people that before Senate Bill 100 was established in 1973 would be able to build on their property and be involved in that. And any thinking we believe that's less than this is just pushing us into more and more social engineering, as we have seen involved in this state when you compare it to other states. And I was just enjoying myself in another state where we own property and talking to property owners down there, a lot of ranchers and farmers around, and they can't believe what we've involved ourselves and allowed to happen in the state of Oregon when it comes down to being able to do what you want to do on your own private property. within some decent guidelines, especially when it's, when we're talking about billing a residence on property that you want to work on or just live on. We would like to be in full support of those amendments to whatever the committee would choose. Thank you.
Do you have any suggestions for us concerning date changes or the referral?
I think dash four is probably about the best. That's what we prefer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Arch Lack, Association of Oregon.
Good morning. Chair Close, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I just wanted to take a second to share a couple of points with you this morning. First, as you know, the existing law for plot of record is optional for counties. It's a may. And while most counties have adopted a lot of record provisions with their ordinances, there are a couple that haven't. I can't tell you the reasons for those, why the county, those counties haven't done it, but they did go through a process to determine whether they thought it was in the best interest of their agriculture and forest communities to do that. And I think that that local option should be preserved at this point. Secondly, there's been discussion about the impact of water record and what it would do. And I know Chair Close, you and Representative Morgan both sit on the Land Use and Regulatory Fairness Committee. I would just share with the committee that that lot of record and the impact of lot of record kinds of issues is one of the fundamental issues that will be considered as part of the Measure 7 discussion. Counties are assisting that Representative Williams and the committee with providing them information with respect to the vacant land and resource zones, looking at the amount of land, the number of undeveloped lots, also trying to look at ownership as it relates to individual lots, looking at ownership contrasted to just each individual property at this point. That information, much better than what we have today, is probably a couple of weeks out at this point. And I think that that information would be, just as it's going to be vital in looking at the Measure 7 discussion, would be very important information to have before this committee, should you, you know, as you continue to look at this particular bill at this point. So I just wanted to make sure that all the members of the committee were advised that that information is available. Certainly, we would be happy to share it with you, just as it will be shared with the Land Use and Regulatory Fairness Committee.
Thank you. Questions for the counties? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave Honeycutt is not here for Oregonians in Action. They did send a letter saying that they support the bill in the dash four amendment. Okay, is there anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3654. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2370 and call Chris Green of the Oregon State Bar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Chris Crane. I am a lawyer with the law firm of Miller Nash in Portland. And before that, I was, until last summer, actually, I was with Legislative Council for 5 years. And House Bill 2370 is one that I drafted before I left Leg Council last year. I did a similar bill in 99, and it's my own personal version of a revisor's bill for the chapters that I worked in when I was with Leg Council. And it cleans up series references, some of the internal cross-references. The bar looked at it and said, this is a great housekeeping law improvement bill. Doesn't change anything substantively. When I was with Leg Council drafting this, and I did the same thing I did in 99, ran it by the home builders and 1,000 friends in the department, and everybody is okay with the bill. That's why the bar asked me to come down and see if we could move it. So if you really want a long, involved explanation about series references within the ORS and what is substantive and non-substantive and why you have those little notes at the bottom of the section that says this section was enacted by the 1999 legislature but was, and was placed into the chapter but was not placed to any series therein, see the preface for explanation. I can give you the preface explanation about what all those notes mean if you really want it. But this is a housekeeping bill that just cleans up some internal references within a few chapters. I ran it by everybody before I drafted it and sent it out, so I don't know. I think nobody even else has signed up to testify on it, but I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Could you define everybody?
Boy, you know, it's funny coming back here in different capacity and seeing all the same faces. Everybody that I talked to in 5 years on a land use issue at Ledge Council, or just about everybody. There's some folks who care a lot about airplanes in Clackamas County that I don't think I talked to about this bill.
But you talked to the major players, Thousand Friends.
Thousand Friends, yeah, the department, the home builders, the realtors, everybody. I did it the same thing in 99, and it's my own. It's basically a housekeeping bill for the chapters that I worked in when I was the drafter at Ledge Council for these chapters. So it cleans up a lot of editorial, just sort of historical accretion. If one great example is on page 5, lines 24 and 25, you see a lot of ORS numbers that were added to those definitions over the years. And each time the legislature enacted another bill and it was added there, it got its own ORS number. So what I did was refer to them collectively as 215.010 to 215.311 and took out all the ones in between so you can refer to them collectively now instead of having to list out each one every time you refer to them. So that's the kind of, and that's just, you know, you'll get those long strings of ORS numbers as legislatures enact bills over the years. Every time something else is added and gets included in the definition, it gets its own ORS number. But really over the, at a certain point, it gets cumbersome when you can just refer to them collectively. So that's why I did this bill. And the bar looked on it, thought it was good, blessed it, asked me to come down and see if I could. Yes.
So can I ask you who exactly you work for?
Oh, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. This bill is sponsored by the Oregon State Bar. I currently work for the law firm of Miller Nash in Portland.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, questions? Representative Kapoor.
I would just like to say that I think this is a sign of government efficiency, and I congratulate Mr. Crane for bringing this forward in a clean statute for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pori. I'm honored by your show of support, but in all fairness, I should point out that I'm also a constituent of Representative Pori.
I think there's
thank you.
Contributions value there that needs to be declared.
Madam Chair.
That's right.
Representative Kim.
I'd be interested in hearing the more full explanation at our 3:00 hearing.
I'd be glad to come back.
You don't need to do that. I think we'll probably all be the only one here. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2370, we're going to consider that further and bring it back to make sure that it checks out everything that's been presented to us. Okay, we did have scheduled House Bill 3563, but that group is not willing to come forth. Is that right?
The proponents are.
Okay. The proponents are not here. The people against it are. So we're not going to be hearing that bill this morning. Yeah, we should tap that. Excuse me. So I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3563 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3563. Is there anything else for the good of the committee? Seeing none, thank you, everyone. Have a good weekend. We will be here at 3:00
in hearing room 3.
Was it this room or
3:57? 3:57. 5 minutes. It'll be a tap. That's right. The 3:00 is because we did not schedule a bill for hearing that we reconsidered on. So that's why we will tap it at 3:00. We missed the deadline, the 8:00 deadline for posting. We are adjourned.